It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, one of the largest clinical labs in the country has released data on employee drug test results. We'll find out more about the rise in the use of cocaine, meth, marijuana, and other drugs. First, companies can require workers to settle employment disputes through individual arbitration. In a decision affecting an estimated 25 million non-unionized workers around the country, the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday sided with Verona-based Epic Systems and two other employers. The companies prevented workers from using class action litigation to sort out disputes over pay, hours, and other conditions. A group of Epic employees said they were being denied overtime pay they were entitled to. They took legal action to void the arbitration agreements they had signed. The court's five conservatives said that while the policy could be debated, the law is clear. Arbitration agreements mean what they say. The four liberal justices said the ruling will be especially hard on low-wage, vulnerable workers. Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. Steph, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, is this ruling a big deal? Is this going to have a big impact potentially?
Yeah, one thing that's important to understand is that employees on the job market don't necessarily have much choice. A majority, actually over a majority, of non-union private sector jobs seem to have these kind of clauses in it. So in terms of shopping around, it's difficult to find positions without these arbitration clauses.
And if I sign up, I take a job, I click a box on my online application, or I sign a piece of paper, whatever, that has an arbitration agreement in it. What does that mean for me as an employee? What kind of conditions does it set?
Well, one of the things to know is that each of the arbitration clauses can be different. So they can sort of be a broad arbitration clause where you pretty much waive all rights to go to court for many different reasons, or it can be a narrower one. For instance, I think Uber has just recently decided to not have mandatory arbitration for sexual harassment claims. That said, the sort of broadest arbitration clauses mean that you have to, instead of going to court, you have to go to an arbitrator. And some of the concerns that are raised by both employment advocates and consumer advocates are that arbitration doesn't provide the full-on protection that the court system does. You don't have full discovery, meaning you can't get all the data about what's going on. The companies are actually the employers of the arbitration companies, since they're the ones contracting for these services. And there's oftentimes, these are often confidential. So you can't tell, as an employee, whether or not a company's gone through a lot of negative arbitration decisions. So you can't really tell where to go for, you know, appropriate employment.
And the other commonly used option here is this idea of the class action lawsuit. Can you talk about how that works when not just one employee, but a group of employees try to take a company to court?
Yeah, one of the reasons why class action lawsuits are appealing to employee rights advocates is that a lot of times these kinds of disputes don't involve a lot of money. That is, you know, this, I think each claim for each employee in this situation was pretty much like $1,000. The type of work that it takes for an attorney to actually raise this claim on behalf of an employee is often, you know, it often involves many, many hours of work. And so it's often very difficult for employees to find attorneys that will represent them, because cost-benefit-wise, it's just not going to be fruitful for an attorney to spend numbers of hours for just this sort of small amount of money. And so class actions allow all of these sorts of claims to be grouped together into a single umbrella, making it more worthwhile for attorneys and thus making it more easy for employees to find attorneys that are willing to represent them in these sorts of claims.
So if I'm an attorney, say, and I see one client who says, hey, I got shorted $3,000 in overtime, I'm going to charge more than $3,000 probably to represent them. If there are 1,000 employees, then maybe it's worth everybody's time to hire that attorney.
Exactly.
So what does this mean, this ruling mean, that we're going to see fewer class action lawsuits by employees?
Well, especially if the cases, as I mentioned before, about 56% of non-union private sector employees operate under these conditions, under the Supreme Court decision, they're automatically not going to be able to raise these claims because they've already signed it away in their contracts. Moving forward, one thing arguably that employees can do is they can either renegotiate their existing contracts, or they can go through and seek employment at places that don't have these arbitration clauses. But like you said, you know, it's going to be a limited amount of choice that they have.
And this could be, some people have been saying this could be an incentive for more employers to put these arbitration clauses in their employee handbooks because the U.S. Supreme Court has said, yep, we're going to honor that.
Exactly. And there's an additional complication. And so I don't come at any of this from a sort of employment labor law background, but I do have some expertise in contracts. And one thing that a lot of these contracts, these employment contracts have, is also confidentiality agreements. So a lot of times these clauses, these employment contracts, aren't even available to the public. So if you're, say, a random person looking for a job, you won't know going into the job before interviewing and stuff like that, whether or not that employer will have an arbitration clause in their agreement. And so it's hard in terms of choice on the behalf of the employee to necessarily know until you get to that position where you've finally interviewed, gone through the process, gotten the job, and then you have this sort of take it or leave it. And you can't even disclose necessarily to others that this employer is using arbitration clauses.
But the argument from the conservative majority in the Supreme Court is still, you've gone through that process, you've seen the arbitration clause, you've signed that contract, so you have to honor that contract.
Yeah, and this is where the sort of statutory interpretation element comes in, because this is actually a complicated case involving two different statutes. One was the Federal Arbitration Act, which was passed in the 1920s, and the other is National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in 1935. Now, the FAA, Federal Arbitration Act, was initially designed because courts were not at all actually enforcing arbitration agreements. And so this gave some weight to arbitration agreements, or shorthand. The National Labor Relations Act, however, was passed in the sort of New Deal era, guaranteeing more employee rights. And the question became before the Supreme Court is which act sort of basically governs this case. And that's where the sort of majority and the dissent disagree, because it's not simply about whether or not to give weight to these agreements. It's about whether or not the National Labor Relations Act, through its language of protecting, let me look at the language, other collective activities for the purposes of collective bargaining or other mutual aid protection, whether or not that specifically prohibits the sort of enforcement of these arbitration agreements.
Talking to Steph Tighe, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, looking at yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on arbitration in workplaces. So let me see if I'm following that, Steph. With the National Labor Relations Act, it says, hey, workers, you do have a right to certain kinds of collective action. The argument from the minority in the Supreme Court is you can't sign away those rights that are guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act. These contracts, these arbitration contracts, don't override these protections. That's their argument?
Yeah, and that the class actions themselves fall under the category of other corrective actions for the purposes of collective bargaining or mutual aid or protection.
Some people have brought up the Me Too movement and issues of sexual harassment and are concerned that this ruling might also make it difficult for women in particular in workplaces to report sexual harassment, to file class action lawsuits. Do you see that as a possible outcome of this decision?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting part, because I do think it's a possible outcome. I tend to be kind of a legal realist in the sense that, you know, that the Supreme Court is probably going to have to weigh in on this, and it'll depend on, you know, what the particular justices' individual takes on this is. However, if you look at the dissent, there's this really interesting part where Ginsburg specifically says, no, I do not interpret this as applying to sexual harassment. And so kind of trying to maybe avoid having the majority's reasoning apply to sexual harassment suits in the future. And so I expect that if any court has to deal with this in the future, they're going to cite that language in Ginsburg dissent.
A lot of these class action lawsuits, including the ones in the Epic case, relate to what people call wage theft, to not getting paid overtime, that kind of thing. Some of these things would be in violation of federal law. It might seem weird to people to say, okay, these arbitration contracts limit your options in dealing with your employer's violation, as you see it, of federal, I don't know if it's civil law, I guess not criminal law. Is that part of the story here?
That's kind of the story. It wasn't full on raised in this particular case. And also, here's where I just admit lack of expertise. I'm not a labor and employment lawyer. So there's probably details that I'm missing on that front.
And if it ended up in criminal behavior, like certain kinds of sexual harassment, sexual discrimination might enter into, I don't know, can that override these arbitration clauses then?
Yeah, because a prosecutor can always bring a claim. The arbitration is about pretty much the employee versus the employer. But the prosecutors are not party to these agreements, and so they can raise any kind of claims they want. The same thing goes when you're asking about sort of violation of federal law. Any kind of federal agency or even a state sort of employment agency can still raise claims because they're not parties to these agreements.
And I want to talk about how much changes. I mean, have courts generally said, oh, well, we've got this arbitration agreement signed by the employer and the employee. We're going to respect that. Was it working this way even before the Supreme Court ruling yesterday?
Well, it was mixed before the circuits, which is why the Supreme Court granted cert. Usually the Supreme Court doesn't grant cert unless there's sort of what they call a circuit split. So different circuits were reaching different conclusions on the employee front. Now, from the general arbitration kind of front, though, the Supreme Court has kind of signaled in recent years that it's heading towards sort of a broader enforcement of arbitration agreements in general under the Federal Arbitration Act, because there's been two big cases, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion and American Express versus Italian Colors, that dealt with arbitration agreements in the consumer context and, you know, whether or not class action lawsuits can be raised. And for those, they sort of said, yes, well, the Federal Arbitration Act plays a strong role.
I wanted to ask about that consumer angle, because when we click that user agreement for the website or the software, or when we buy a product that has the fine print or something like that, there might be that arbitration clause there that affects me as a consumer. Does this Supreme Court ruling on employee arbitration clauses, does that affect me not as an employee, as a consumer?
Well, they've already said that it does, not in this case, but in two earlier cases, the cases I mentioned, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, American Express versus Italian Colors. So they've already said that. So that's why, in some ways, this particular case, the Epic case, wasn't a complete surprise, because the court was already headed that way in terms of consumer actions.
And briefly, Steph, as we wrap up, I mean, is the contract world, the workplace world, different today than it was yesterday before that ruling?
It was, because I think at least employee advocates were hoping that the Supreme Court wouldn't apply the Federal Arbitration Act to these kinds of class action agreements to sort of litigate, because it fell under the National Labor Relations Act. And so now this sort of possibility has been removed.
Steph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Glad to talk to you.
Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision that says companies can require workers to accept individual arbitration clauses. Right now, one of the largest medical labs in the country has released a report about employee drug test results. The data compiles test info found between 2016 and 2017. A large majority of the positive test results were from use of cocaine, methamphetamine, and marijuana, with the use of cocaine up 13% and the use of meth over 100%. Shemaine Mills is a WPR reporter covering health and healthcare in Wisconsin. Shemaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, you're reporting that drug use by workers is at the highest rate in more than 10 years. Where does this data come from? Who is it measuring?
Well, it comes from a company called Quest Diagnostics, and they're one of the largest labs in the country that does drug testing in the workplace. They did over 10 million tests across the U.S. and found that drug use is indeed up for a number of substances.
And what substances were they finding? We hear a lot about the opioid problem in the news. What are they finding in prospective workers?
What they found was a lot of methamphetamine and a lot of cocaine, which to me was surprising because, like you mentioned, we hear so much about opioids and the epidemic and how we have all these people using painkillers or heroin. But that isn't what they were finding. And in fact, nationally, they found opioid use was down. Now, here in Wisconsin, those that were tested by this company, opioid use was up, but not as much as methamphetamines, which were up over 100%.
And do they cover particular industries and they find particular things in particular lines of work?
Yeah, there are certain industries that have to test their workers. For instance, commercially licensed drivers. Think of semi-truck drivers, those who use heavy equipment, those who work for the Defense Department, those in aviation. So safety-related issues. Now, of course, there are other businesses that choose to drug test their workers. Wisconsin law isn't yay or nay. It doesn't say you have to. It doesn't say you can't. So in large part, it's up to the companies what they want to do.
And as we mentioned, we're seeing higher rates, the highest rate in more than 10 years. How big is the scope? How much is drug use growing as measured by these employee drug tests?
Well, first of all, Quest only measured 100,000 drug tests here in Wisconsin. It did many more across the country. So we don't know what percentage of drug testing they're doing in Wisconsin, but I did talk to someone at Bell & Health. They use a different company, and they found results comparable mm-hmm. to what Quest came up with. So she said, yeah, we are seeing methamphetamine just rise exponentially, and along with cocaine, and marijuana has been steady over the years. But like I said before, they've also seen opioid use increase. So it's pretty troubling, she said, how fast it's rising and short period of time. This is only over a year.
Is this something that's making it harder for employers to find people to hire?
Oh, yeah. This woman I interviewed at Bell, and they have clients, and these clients are companies. And they have gone so far as to ask, can we do a drug panel where they exclude certain drugs, for instance, marijuana? And right now, it's illegal in many states, so the answer, of course, is no, we still have to test for this. But a number of companies can't find workers. Our unemployment rate is less than 3% right now. I mean, the governor's touting how low it is, which is great, except for the fact it makes it more difficult to find workers, not only who are competent, but who can pass a drug test.
Right. And some of these drugs, because of federal law, if the prospective employee tests positive for any of these drugs, they can't hire them by law, right?
Right, right. So she said, for one company she talked to, up to 50% of their applicants are excluded right off the bat. So they may be qualified, but if they can't pass the drug test, they're out.
I don't know if you've taken this step yet, but are employers trying to figure out, are we going to have to offer drug counseling so that these prospective employees who can't pass the test now can maybe work for us in, I don't know, 6-8 months?
Well, I wasn't able to talk to any companies, and I did reach out to Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and didn't get an answer back. That's why I talked to an intermediary, Bell & Health, which talks to the companies, and she said they are trying to deal with it with counseling and whatnot, but the crunch is getting people at the front end. People, they need to hire more people and not so much deal with existing employees. So there is a law. Has very little chance of passing. A Milwaukee lawmaker would like to make it illegal to require marijuana testing for employment. Now, like I said, I'm not sure of its chances, but that's out there. So there's recognition that this is an issue in the workforce.
Even if that did pass in Wisconsin, I'm assuming federal law would still apply in many of these cases, no matter what a Wisconsin legislature said.
Exactly. Exactly. Because there are certain industries, aviation and trucking, where you have to be tested.
So what are the people you talk to watching for? Do they think maybe this is a blip, or are they thinking this is going to keep on going up in the years to come?
Well, it's been as high as 13% when we had the federal law enacted, the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act in 1988. It was 13%. So there's been progress. However, it's fluctuated. It's gone up. It's gone down. And if the opioid epidemic is any indication, this is a tough nut to crack. once people start using or are addicted to drugs, it can be tough to stop. And for certain workers, they use them, they will say, to help them in their job. For instance, truckers want to stay awake. So cocaine and methamphetamine are uppers. They will, you know, increase the amount of time that you can drive without taking a rest.
We'll leave it there for now. Shemaine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Shemaine Mills, WPR reporter. She joined us to talk about data showing that drug use by workers is at the highest rate in over a decade. First, more than 67 million people around the United States rely on Medicaid for their health care. Medicaid's a federal program, but states fund and implement Medicaid in different ways. And the way those states provide benefits can differ a lot from place to place. Medicaid is frequently at the center of political debates, and state governments have the ability to implement changes to the program or scale back services. Case in point, Wisconsin lawmakers floated work requirements for Badger Care recipients last year. And the political conversations and cuts to Medicaid can actually have a significant impact on the political participation of the people who benefit from the program. Our next guest has been studying this issue and just published in-depth research on the topic. Jamila Michener is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She's the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Jamila, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be back.
Well, you spend time on the politics and the policy and the numbers, Jamila, but you make a point that you don't want to lose track of the individual stories of people who feel the impact of Medicaid and how it varies from state to state. I was hoping you could tell us some about Terry from the Atlanta area who kind of helped you start off on this project.
Yeah. So Terry was a woman that I met when I went to Georgia specifically to interview people for this book. Before that, I had talked to people where I was in Michigan at the time and where I had been in Chicago, but I knew that people's experiences were going to be different. And I wanted to talk to more people. And she was one of the first people that I met when I went to Georgia. I met her outside of a Medicaid office, and we agreed to meet up later and talk. And her experiences really helped to shape the direction of my research. When I asked her to tell me about herself, before I even asked her for any other information, she immediately started talking about Medicaid and how different it was from place to place. She had been throughout her life in many different states. She had lived in California, she had lived in Ohio, she'd lived in Washington and Illinois. And so she had this kaleidoscopic sense of how varied the program was across places. And she could tell me in a really direct and compelling way what that meant for her as a citizen, how it felt to know that what you got from the government was so heavily dependent on where you lived.
And you also talked about the story of John. You mentioned Michigan earlier. John, who felt like he was married to the state of Michigan because of his physical condition and the way Medicaid coverage worked there versus other states.
Yeah, so John had lived in Michigan his whole life, and he was thinking about moving to Arizona at the time that I talked to him. And a lot of his friends and family were also planning on making that move to a warmer climate. He had a chronic health condition, which was one of the reasons why he was a Medicaid beneficiary, and he thought that the move would be good for his health and he could stay near friends and family. However, when he started to research the services that he would get if he moved to Arizona, I mean, if it's any reflection, Arizona's Medicaid program is titled the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. And so he realized that when he moved there, he wasn't going to be able to get the kind of benefits that he got in Michigan. And it's not because Michigan is super generous. It's because Arizona, for the specific benefits he needed, was quite pivy. And it was literally this decision about what state to live in became a life or death decision for him. And he decided to stay put. And he said, you know, I guess I'd live on Mars if I had to, because I need these services. I need my chronic illness treated. And that really represented a point in his life where he felt as though Michigan Medicaid and Medicaid throughout the country determined what he could do, where he could go, what the kind of upward ceiling and constraint was in his life. And that was pretty moving for me to hear. And it was also spoke to the structure of our policy and what it means for people on a day-to-day basis.
Let's zoom out a little bit. Basically, what is Medicaid? Who is being served by Medicaid?
So Medicaid is an intergovernmental healthcare program that is the dual responsibility of both states and the federal government. A lot of the services for Medicaid are paid for by the federal government, but the states also take on some of the cost. And it is a program that is specifically targeted to provide health insurance for low-income Americans, as well as for Americans who have severe disabilities and are medically needy, and as well as increasingly for elderly Americans who need services like long-term care, nursing home services, and essentially run out of funds to be able to pay for those things. So there are lots of different kinds of people who rely on Medicaid, but overwhelmingly, most beneficiaries are from low-income backgrounds, and many of them are hardworking Americans, but they simply cannot get health insurance through their jobs or through other avenues.
And as I understand it, a lot of people who are on Medicaid don't know they're on Medicaid. They might be in Wisconsin, they're on Badger Care. The word Medicaid isn't front and center, and the same story is true with different names in state after state, right?
That's absolutely true. You know, in California, it's Medi-Cal, and in Georgia, it's Peach Care. And some beneficiaries realize that it's Medicaid and others don't. And that has different kinds of implications. When I was interviewing people, I realized I needed to, when I asked them about their experiences, tailor the name of the program, because if I just said Medicaid, some people wouldn't even know what I was talking about. And so when it comes to thinking about what it means to mobilize, to protect benefits and to protect a program, that gets challenging when people may not even know that they are benefiting from the program.
Jamila Michener is with us talking about her new book, Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Jamila, this is a big deal in and of itself that from state to state, these Medicaid benefits vary so much. It'll determine maybe what state people move to. You say there's something even more fundamental going on here, something about what it means to be a citizen. Can you talk about that? Make that connection for us.
Yeah, well, I'm a political scientist, and so I spend a lot of my time thinking about how government policies, programs, and decisions affect democracy. And I pay special attention to political participation, whether or not people are going to engage and be a part of the political processes that shape what happens in their lives. And I really care about thinking about the folks on the margins, people who are living below the poverty line, people who are disadvantaged and face life challenges in a variety of ways. Many of those people are precisely the kind of people that are covered through Medicaid. And the question I really center in the book is, does their experience with Medicaid boost their political participation, or does it affect it in a negative way? What is the relationship between being enrolled in a program like Medicaid and participating in politics and having a voice in democracy? What I find is that overall, there's a negative relationship there. Medicaid beneficiaries are less likely to participate, even if you control for all of the other factors that you might think explain that, for the fact that they're more likely to be poor or have health challenges or what have you. There's something about the experience of Medicaid that is demobilizing people. But the key thing I find in the book is that that really varies across place. It's not the same everywhere. And in some states, being a beneficiary is a boost for participation. In others, it depresses participation. And that varies across states, counties, neighborhoods. And it depends on the design and the implementation of the program. So the choices that we make about how to treat people, about how much to give them, about how easy or difficult to make their life as they encounter this government program, can determine whether or not they're fully incorporated into our democracy.
For people who saw that negative impact, how did they talk about that? How did they talk about Medicaid and political participation?
People talk about it in a number of ways. One way is that Medicaid can often teach people about the limits of the government. If you have needs, if you need physical therapy, or you need a hearing aid, or you need glasses, and you're part of this government healthcare program, but it does not provide those things, and there's constant discourse of just scarcity and of an inability to pay and provide, people learn pretty quickly the government is really limited. And even when they're well-intentioned, there's just a lot that they either cannot or will not do for you. And so the incentive to participate, to engage in the political process, it's not there in the way it would be if you understood the government to be able to be effective and to be able to provide the resources that you need. The other thing is that these policy changes that happen with Medicaid constantly, we're expanding, no, we're cutting, you know, now we're going to do drug testing, or now we're going to do work requirements, oh, then we'll change it. That really sends the message that the government is capricious, that it's arbitrary, that you don't know what hoops you're going to have to jump through. You don't know what kinds of policy changes you're going to have to endure. You can't rely on your state government or your federal government to make sure that your needs are met on the basis of the fact that you are a human being who has healthcare needs. There are all sorts of political and other factors that will determine what you get and whether you get it. Again, that sends a signal about what kind of relationship you have to the government and what kind of government you live under. And those signals teach people lessons about whether they should bother engaging in politics.
We're talking to Jamila Michener. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University and the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. She's with us to talk about how changes to Medicaid can have an impact on recipients' political participation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you receive Medicaid benefits, Badger Care benefits, what has your experience been like? Have you worked with the system in different states? What kind of differences did you see? And what impact do state politics have on you when it comes to this issue? And do you participate in state politics if you're a Medicaid or Badger Care recipient? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the politics of Medicaid with Jamila Michener. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University and the author of the new book, Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Medicaid? If you receive benefits from Medicaid via Badger Care here in Wisconsin, what has your experience been like? Do you participate politically as a Medicaid, a Badger Care recipient? Have you experienced the system in different states? What differences have you seen? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now. Kevin is with us in Crandon. Kevin, hi.
Hello. I told your screener that it's been my experience and my observations, and I guess just gut feeling tells me that as far as being, you know, politically active and everything and getting out there, I'd like to do it, but I feel as though it's in my best interest to just keep my head low and not draw any attention to myself, because people can be really negative if they find out you're on SSI and getting Medicaid and all that. It can draw some real bad reactions.
Kevin, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Jamila, is that something you heard from the people you talked to?
Absolutely. One of the things that I talk about in the book is just the stigmatization that comes with a program like Medicaid. And many people that I interviewed talk about stigma. And at one point, you know, there's a woman who talks about just laying low and how it's better to lay low because you risk less. And many beneficiaries talk about how they're perceived by other people, by bureaucrats who work in the office. And there are these forces that are really pushing people to lay low and not engage. But the voices of Medicaid beneficiaries and other policy beneficiaries are the voices we need in our politics to make sure that we're making choices that benefit everyone and not just the few. And so it really is this perverse reality that the very people whose lives are dependent on these policies end up not having a say in how the policies are constructed.
You also write about that stigma potentially affecting the quality of care, or at least where clinics are located, the conditions that people have as they go into them. In some cases, if society is providing services via Medicaid, there's a sense of, okay, we'll provide this. We don't want it to be too nice.
Yeah, and so the context in which people receive Medicaid, when you're going to a clinic that's on a block that is decrepit, in a building that is falling apart, and you have the services that just re-inscribe and re-emphasize for you the kinds of inequalities that you're dealing with in life more generally, it really sends a message, you know, we'll do this if we have to, but you're not a priority, you're not important. And so then why would you engage and participate? And I think that those kinds of inequalities we need to be paying attention to, and anything that brings stigma. So when we say, these people aren't working hard enough, let's make them work through work requirements, or these people maybe are on drugs, let's drug test them. All of these things send signals about who we think Medicaid beneficiaries are, and they reinforce the very stigma that keeps those folks from being a part of our political process.
Kevin, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Chris with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi, I'm elderly disabled and on Medicaid, and it always worked perfectly fine, never had a problem. About 3 months ago, I got a huge manila envelope full of stuff from the state of Wisconsin saying that I had to pick an HMO and that there were 6 listed. I bristled immediately. I tried to squirm out of it for 2 months, kept getting phone calls from advocacy advocates, and I finally got one last week that said that I asked if I had an hour of time, and I asked why, because she was doing an advocacy evaluation. And I said, what is it? She said, I'm going to take a complete medical history of you over the telephone. I said, no way in heck is that going to happen. I don't give my medical history to anybody except my doctor. And I said, I'm trying to squirm out of this. I don't want this. She told me to call the state back. The woman from the state said, you can't squirm out of this. I said, watch me. So I want to tell everybody that they should call representatives Chris Taylor's office. They're working on trying to figure this out because she's on the health committee and the legislature doesn't know anything about this. Scott Walker just put this under the table. My thought about that is he's running for re-election and he wants money from these big HMOs. And you can get out of it. If we bond together, we can get out of it. We can stop this. And I also got a call back this morning from Tammy Baldwin's office. I called her too, but she doesn't have jurisdiction, but she should be let know because this is federal money.
Chris, thanks for the call. Jamila, you write about people advocating for themselves personally in the system.
Yeah.
And as we hear here, Chris is doing that and advocating politically.
Yeah, so this is great. And in the chapter 7 of my book, I talk about people precisely like Chris who just called in. So it's not the norm for beneficiaries to be really active, to really push back, to fight, and then to try to mobilize others. So that this move that she said, hey, but we can, more people need to do this if we bond together. That kind of thinking isn't the norm. But when it happens, I talk about this in the book, it can be really compelling and really effective. And I talk about a group of women in Iowa responding to this exact thing, this onset of Medicaid managed care and having to deal with these different managed care organizations and all of the challenges that brings. And they really push back and they try to fight for oversight and for protection. And it sets it's a great model for what's possible. And it may not be what's likely, but when it happens, it can mean a lot. So, you know, I applaud those efforts. If something isn't right, if something about your benefits isn't right, to push back and to realize that you do have a voice and you do matter and have a power that you can use to make sure that you get what you need. Because sometimes this is life and death. It's healthcare. It matters deeply.
Talking to Jamila Michener, author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Back to your call. Steve is with us in Trigo. Steve, hi.
Howdy. I would just like to say I really appreciate this topic and the author's take on all this. I worked for community organizations here in Wisconsin organizing on behalf of the Badger Care expansion back in 2013 and 2014. And we knocked on a lot of doors in low-income areas, and it became very clear that a lot of people don't understand that they're on Medicaid. The scope of Medicaid, for example, that it's the largest health insurance plan in America, happens to be a public health insurance plan. And there's a lot of insularity between those that are affected, for example, low-income folks, and the disability rights community, which absolutely depend on Medicaid to stay independent in the community. So educating people like this program is doing is absolutely essential. And I would guess our experience working with people who previously had not had a lot of engagement with civic life or politics is when they understood what was at stake for them, they're eager to get involved, and they're very capable of getting involved.
Steve, I want to jump in and give Jamila a chance to weigh in on that. Jamila, your thoughts.
Yeah, this is great. I appreciate this caller, Steve, for pointing this out. So this is part of my motivation for writing the book, is so that we can understand the lay of the land, so that we have a sense of what are some steps we can take to get people mobilized. And it's absolutely true that there is a disconnect between different subgroups of beneficiaries of Medicaid. So the disability rights and the disability advocacy community more generally tends to really be strong. These are the folks that we see protesting. These are the folks we see coming out when threats are cuts are threatened, and they have a kind of political resources and the ability to mobilize and to garner just large sympathy from the population more generally. But there is a disconnect between them and the kind of average low-income beneficiary, and even people, for example, whose elderly parents rely on long-term care. And if they couldn't get that from Medicaid, they would have to be taking care of their parents. There are all these groups of people who benefit so much from this program, and they simply do not work together, and they are not aware of each other in a way that allows beneficiaries to mobilize across the board to protect what it is that they're getting and that they need to be getting. And so this kind of thinking and just informing people makes a difference. You at least should know, so that you can take action when and if necessary.
Steve, thanks for that call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Jamila, do you see things changing? Do you see people who are on the fringes politically, people who are receiving Medicaid, getting more involved in political advocacy?
I'll be honest and say I don't see that, but I'll also say that I can see it only because since the publication of the book, I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of advocacy organizations, and many of them are turning in this direction. Instead of simply focusing on advocating on behalf of Medicaid beneficiaries, they're thinking about how to equip them to advocate for themselves and how to expand that so more of that happens. And I think when we start to see processes unfold to make that happen and to encourage it, we can see a very different political landscape, and not in ways that are just about, you know, one party or the other, not that, but in ways that are about providing people with what they need.
Jamila, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jamila Michener, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She joins us today to talk about the intersection of Medicaid, political participation, and how states implement federal programs. Her latest book is Fragmented Democracy: Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Yesterday, I asked you to share the names of your pets, and boy, howdy, did you, plus some pictures, too. I will now shout out to as many of your pets as I can in the next 80 seconds or so. On Twitter, we heard from someone who said, my dog is a teddy bear. His name is Ted Jansen. In fact, this is his account. It's from the Twitter account, Tedward Jansen, parentheses, dog, and parentheses. Judy says, Rowena and Salazar are sweet kitties. Those are from Harry Potter, I think. Teresa says, my guinea pigs are named Scout and Jem, soon to be joined by Dill. A listener in the UP says, Miko, Boo, and Valiant are our Youper cats. Judith says, my cat's name is Gypsy. Gypsy loves to travel. And there's a picture in the backseat of the car, happier than I've ever seen a cat in a car. Reed has Bert the cat. Jim has Butch the dog and Mr. Grapes the cat. Evelyn, our very large German shepherd's name is Misha. Carla has Bella, one of the more popular names, a Bichon Frise Shih Tzu mix, or a teddy bear, 13 years old, rescued at 9 months, came with that name. Is that all? No, I have paper. Amy's dog is named Duke. Duke's a German Shepherd Lab mix. Carla in La Crosse, we did that one. Sean says, my brother wanted me to name our dog Bengal. Ended up switching to Bangle because that's how they said it. A couple cats here. Paul from Wausau. Cat's name is Sheba. Lori from West Allis has three cats. Kid, Fruit Bat, Captain Hook. Captain Hook is missing a paw. Very cute cat. Michelle has a cat named Bones. Another Michelle has dogs named Jenny, Johnny, Tucker, Seamus, and Jake. That's all I can get through. I got plenty more. Maybe we'll do this again sometime. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.